Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have convened, thank you, the inaugural for the 2017 Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today is February the 6th, 2017. We are gathered together for the purpose of an informational meeting. We will do member introductions and then turn the meeting over to Mr. Bender, who I think will go down and testify to the committee. So with that, Co-Chair Gomberg.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, and thank you so much. It's good to be back here and working with you again. For those of you that are serving for the first time on the committee, Senator Johnson and I were honored to co-chair this committee last session, and I don't know what how much detail are you looking for in
just
committee?
Say we did excellent work and leave it
was,
at that.
There was absolutely no question. We did superlative work last session, and we're going to try and echo that again this session, although the circumstances are a little different as we look toward the co-chair's initial budget proposal that we're going to be starting with. You know, I am looking forward to Mr. Bender giving everybody an overview of the process here. I think you'll find it unique and a little distinct from the way a lot of other committees operate, not the least of which being, of course, first, that we have co-chairs, second of all, that we have rotating staff that comes in and out, and that we see agencies that come in and talk to us about budgets, and then we wait a few weeks, and then we come back and see them all again. One of the things that I'll note for your interest is that in addition to doing a good job with the budgets that we have, I'm bringing forward a particular interest in the issue of uncollected state debt. And I talked about that a little bit here last session and challenged some of the different agencies on the question of how much money is owed to them. And what are they doing to collect it? And that's a question that I intend to continue asking as we move forward. Some agencies having much more money on the books than others, but I'll look forward to your interest in that subject and your patience as we pursue it in a little more depth.
For the record, what part of the state do you represent?
For the record.
The coast.
I represent House District 10, which is the Central Oregon coast and the Coast Range. I represent from Yahats in the south to Tillamook in the north and inland as far as Sheridan and Falls City, which means I have portions of Lincoln, Tillamook, Yamhill, and Polk counties.
Okay. Let's stay on the House side.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my name is State Representative Mike Neerman. I'm not only Representative Gomberg's neighbor on this dais, I'm also his neighbor. My district is up against his there. It's House District 23, which goes from just south of Newburg all the way to the Lane County line. It's a lot of rural area in the western Willamette Valley. And I'm happy to be on this committee again. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Jeff Reardon, represent District 48, which is outer southeast Portland down into Happy Valley. I'm excited to be on this committee. I've had a longstanding interest in transportation and economic development. I think everything we do here should rotate around economic growth in our state. Also, I have in my district, I-205 runs through my district. It borders on State Highway 26, which is outer southeast Powell. 82nd Avenue is in my district, which is Highway 813. So we have these orphan highways that are in my district. There are huge issues. So I don't know if that comes up in here. I've never been on a Ways and Means sub. I don't know if you talk about what you talk about for sure, but sounds like a lot of fun. And looking forward to being part of it.
Well, you're going to hear some of that from Mr. Bender momentarily.
Yep.
Representative Meek.
Good afternoon. Mark Meek representing House District 40, which is Gladstone, Oregon City, and some unincorporated sections of Clackamas County. And like Representative Reardon, we have I-205 running through my district, including a couple other state highways, Highway 213 and... 222, 224, yeah, we got a lot of, transportation is very important and vital to us. We actually, we're famous for the bottleneck of the Abernathy Bridge in Oregon City there. So we're going to be looking to hopefully support the development and expansion of that. What's that?
And the locks.
Yeah, and the locks. Yeah, yeah. But at Clackamas County, I was on the Planning Commission there, the chair of the Planning Commission for a couple years, and also involved with their Economic Development Commission. I'm a small businessman and a realtor, so I love both, you know, business aspects and economic development, along with the American Dream and getting folks into homes and housing affordability too.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Ron Noble from House District 24, from McMinnville on the south end all the way up to Hillsborough on the north end, a slice of Hillsborough. So it's all north Yamhill County and south Washington County. Really excited to be here. My background is public safety, although in between college years, I was also an engineering tech for ODOT and helped build some of that Interstate 205 that we just talked about, or that was just talked about, as well as the Salem Bridges and some other projects. Again, just happy to be here and hopefully can participate and add.
Thank you very much. Senate colleagues, I should say, Representative Meek, some of us have had the opportunity to peruse your bridge from its soft underbelly. It was it was one of the stops on our tour, and we were able to gaze at it from the underneath up.
Ooh. So,
Senator.
Madam Co-Chair, it's a pleasure to be with you once again. I'm Senator Rob Monroe, and I represent everything that Jeff Reardon represents, and then twice that much. I'm primarily involved. I've been a lifelong educator, done about everything you can do in education. Also, I've served on transportation committees throughout my tenure. I was first elected to the legislature 40 years ago. And it gives me a lot of pleasure to work with this group once again. I also am in the housing business, and so if economic development, if we're doing something related to housing, I have some interest and involvement there.
Senator Hansel from the frozen east.
My name is Bill Hansel, state senator from District 29, which includes 7.5 counties, start in the northeast corner of Oregon at Hell's Canyon and all the way to the Dalles Dam. I would, after the introductions, I think I'm the only one east of the mountains, so it's a pleasure to be here. Was raised on a wheat and cattle ranch north of Athena, still live in the community. when given the opportunity to make a choice, because another committee I'd served on in the last session was meeting at the same time as this one, I chose this one because we did do great things and appreciate the leadership of the committee very much and look forward to working.
Thank you. I'm Senator Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16, Northern Tillamook County, Clatsop, Columbia, a little Multnomah, in the working waterfront down under the St. John's Bridge, rural Washington County, Gaston, Banks, and then one of the fastest growing parts of Washington County for somewhat inexplicable reasons, Bethany. And I come from an aviation background, trained as a lawyer, never practiced, ended up working as an owner-operator of a commercial helicopter company for 20 years. Our little company motto was, your wallet, we haul it, so we did all sorts of interesting things. And I'm working right now on an economic development opportunity that I think will bring credit not only to our state and our region, but also our country. We're working collaboratively with the Boeing Airplane Company to establish their only North American presence in a training as well as research and development facility. And some of you have listened to this as it has evolved. I'm very pleased to report that we have somewhere in the area between $10 and $12 million worth of donated equipment. And we're pretty heavily underway at this point in bringing what's called OMIC, the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, into reality. So with that, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and subcommittee members. The full committee co-chairs have asked us to provide all subcommittees with a somewhat extended orientation and introduction this session, because there are a large number of members on Ways and Means who are either new to the legislature or new to the Ways and Means Committee. So with your indulgence, Madam Co-Chair, I would like to move to the witness table and start what will really be 2 days of introduction, or orientation, I should say. Today we're going to be focusing on general budget concepts and ways and means processes. Tomorrow we'll focus more on the particular budgets that you have before you today. But if that's all right.
That sounds just great. And while you're going down, I would just share with our new members, particularly those not only new to the committee but new to the legislative process, what a privilege it is to be on Ways and Means, and that this is a somewhat arcane world of budgets and nomenclature and terminology. Please do not hesitate to ask questions. This is very important work that we do, and you shouldn't feel the slightest bit reticent about inquiring if there's something that you don't understand or appreciate. Mr. Bender.
Thank you. What I would like to do today is, I know there are many members of the subcommittee that have considerable expertise and history on Ways and Means. I'm going to try, even though this is designed to be a information organization for people who've had no experience at all on Ways and Means, I'm going to try to hopefully bring up perhaps some things that may be new even to the experienced members. I probably won't succeed in that, but that's my intent as we go through this. My name is, again, is Steve Bender, and I serve as the coordinator for this subcommittee during this session. And in that position, I will be working with the subcommittee co-chairs on scheduling issues and on other issues that are involved with the subcommittee's job of balancing the portions of the budget that are assigned to this particular subcommittee.
May I take the first liberty of interrupting you and just saying the scheduling part includes making sure that the members are aware of when we're meeting, what the agendas are, but it is critically important that you are here punctually. Because we cannot begin our business without a quorum. And so I would just respectfully request that you make these committees a priority and you be here timely.
Madam Chair, and a quorum, if for the sake of illustration, means both houses have to have the quorum, not just the total number of the committee.
Madam Chair, If I could just clarify, many of the meetings we're going to be having will be informational during the first part of the session, but we cannot even begin information hearings without both quorums. So if there is pressing business, for example, if you're testifying in another committee, if you could at least do us the courtesy of stopping by here and letting us convene a quorum, we can proceed informationally without a quorum, but we can't convene without a quorum, and that's an important note.
Okay, Mr. Bender.
I would like to start by talking a bit about Oregon's budget process and focusing on how the Ways and Means Committee perhaps differs from some other committees in the way that it operates. So those are the items that I'm going to be stressing today as we go through this orientation. There is an item stored on OIS that is an I think it's labeled Subcommittee Orientation Memo. And I have it projected here. I just wanted to point out a few things that I think reiterate some of the comments from both of your co-chairs that both of your co-chairs already made this morning or this afternoon. The first is, please let us know if you're unable to attend a meeting. We need to make sure that the subcommittee co-chairs know that, especially as that we do need a quorum even to open up the meeting. So if there's a situation where you're unable to attend, please notify our office. If we need to make other accommodations to make sure that we have a quorum available to start committee business, we'll work toward doing that.
Mr. Bender, would you elaborate on how that can occur?
Okay, yes.
The role of the presiding officers and the co-chairs.
Yes, and as I've outlined here on this memo, there are a number of items that I just wanted to point out about the subcommittee or the Ways and Means rules that are perhaps a bit unique, or if not entirely unique, are different from the way that most of your other committees are functioning. And the first of these is, I could change the order a bit to respond to these questions. In response to Senator Johnson's comments about how can we make accommodations if for some reason you can't be here, I do want to point out that item E here, is notes that under the subcommittee rules, the co-chairs of the full committee may participate in subcommittee meetings and may vote when they're in attendance. So even though Senator Devlin and Representative Nathanson will typically not attend your subcommittee meetings, they can come in at any time and fully participate and vote if they choose to do so. And this is, for example, if we're unable to get a quorum for some reason, we may ask one or both of the full committee co-chairs to attend at least the start of the meeting to allow the meeting to convene. But that is a somewhat unusual rule, I think.
Senator Hanson.
I'm just curious. Can they vote if we have a quorum and they attend?
Okay. They can come at any time. They are not they're not restricted to only attending the meetings when the quorum is not present. So, as you know, typically they do not attend, and they would only come if there was not a quorum or if there were concerns about there not being support for a bill that they had included in their, you know, in their co-chair's budget. Those are the times when they would typically come, but they could come at any time. And if you were having a vote, their vote would be included as a in the vote of the subcommittee.
Yeah.
I'll go through the rest of these, I think, in order. Item A notes that this is quite unusual, I think, compared to how other committees in the legislature operate. The subcommittee must report all budget bills assigned to it back to the full committee. The reason this is unusual is, as you know, on other legislative committees, you have a number of bills assigned to the committee, and not all of those bills are going to get out. At the end of the session, there are going to be a bunch of bills that are still in committee, and indeed, there may be bills where there was never even a hearing held on those bills. Ways and Means is different, at least for the budget committee, budget bills that you have. You not only need to have public hearings and work sessions on them, but you have to report them out. And the co-chairs of the full committee may remove a bill from a subcommittee at any time. Typically, the only reason they would do that is if a subcommittee is unwilling to report a bill out because you can't get a quorum to agree on something that you can report back to the full committee co-chairs do have the option, if they choose to do so, to remove the bill from the subcommittee and put it to another subcommittee of Ways and Means.
Madam Co-Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, typically what happens in that situation is that we would move the bill without recommendation. We don't have the votes to move the bill with a positive recommendation. We normally would move the bill without recommendation because we can't just hold it.
If I may take a detour from going through these rules, I would like to just talk about or show you what these budget bills are that are assigned to this committee. You have 12 of them. Those of you who have served on the subcommittee before, these are the same 12 agencies, as was the case in 2015 and 2013 as well. They're the Department of Aviation, Oregon Business Development Department. I'm not going to read them all here, but these are the 12 bills that have to be reported out. Later in the session, it's very likely or almost certain that the full committee co-chairs will assign other bills that come to Ways and Means for after having been passed out of another committee. These policy bills don't strictly need to be passed out in all cases. So in some cases, the co-chairs will assign a policy bill later in the session and say, tell us what you think, you know, have a hearing, tell us what you think about this bill. And if the subcommittee isn't interested in moving it forward, that might be a bill that just is not reported out. But these are the 12 bills that the rule applies to that must be reported back. The structure of the state budget is organized into what we call broad program areas. And this becomes significant especially when you look back at the co-chair's budget framework that they released last month. What the co-chairs did is they established funding targets separate targets for each of these program areas. They specifically, the program areas can be defined somewhat differently depending upon what the policy goals are, but they established 14 separate and in some sense independent funding targets. This subcommittee has essentially three of them and a portion of the fourth one. The first program area that this subcommittee is assigned to work on is the economic development program area. That consists of four of these budgets. The first one is the Oregon Business Development Department. The second one is the Employment Department. The third one is the Housing and Community Services Department. And the fourth one is Department of Veterans Affairs. These are all four. There are no other subcommittees that have any budgets in the economic development program area. The second program area of which this subcommittee has exclusive authority over is the transportation program area. That consists of two budgets, the Department of Aviation and the Department of Transportation, ODOT. No other subcommittee has assignments in that program area. The third program area of which you have almost all authority over is the Consumer and Business Services program area, which consists of several agencies, DCBS, Consumer Business Services here, BOLI is one of these, PUC is in that area, and Real Estate Agency. There are some other budgets in this program area and other subcommittees, but essentially you have all of the budgets that have general fund or lottery funds in them. So really, as far as the co-chair's budget is concerned, you have authority over that budget target as well. Then there's a fourth one here, and that is the administration budget area. You have a couple of agencies in there. The ones that you have in there are the Racing Commission and OLCC. In this particular case, the administration program area has a lot of budgets in other subcommittees, so you only have a small portion of that part. But this is basically how your workload is organized. You do have several large areas of the budgets over which you have exclusive budget authority. But going back to here, I think there have been some mentions about the quorum. To have a quorum, we need to have at least two senators and three representatives present, and we do need a quorum in order to open the meeting. We need to have, let's see, I'm pretty much going down to F now, I think, budget notes. Budget notes may only clarify or expand upon administrative requirements which are directly related to the execution of budgets during the fiscal period covered. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what that means. And finally, typically, the co-chairs of the full committee will not reassign a bill to the subcommittee after it passes the first chamber. So the process, because this functions as a joint committee, is when you pass a bill out of this subcommittee, this is what's going to happen. What's going to happen is, let's say the first bill you pass, we'll start at the top, is a Department of Aviation bill. When you pass out the bill, it will first go to the full committee. If the full committee then approves it, because it's a Senate bill, it will first go to the Senate chamber. If the Senate chamber approves it, then comes to the House. The Speaker of the House will assign it to Ways and Means. When it's reassigned to Ways and Means, the co-chairs will then basically not bother to sign it to a subcommittee. There won't be a second vote. It'll go directly back to the House floor for concurrence, or not concurrence, for approval. And there are only very rare occasions when you'll see the bill on the second time. If something has changed markedly, or if there was an error in the first bill, which we certainly hope wouldn't be the case, then they can snag it the second time. But generally, once it's out, it's out. And it goes through the process and onto the governor's desk if it passes both chambers. What I'd like to do next, if there are no questions, is go to our overview. And this is an overview that we're doing in common in all six subcommittees. So many of you will get to see this more than once. I think Senator Monroe is the only person who's probably seen this already today. But I would like to talk a bit about the budget process and about our office. And please let me know if you have any questions as I go through this. One of the important things to note is that there is a constitutional responsibility of the legislature to balance the budget. If you looked at the Constitution, you wouldn't see anywhere specifically the language that the legislature must balance the budget. But there are three separate sections in Article 9 that together require you to do that, because you're required to provide revenue to pay for current state expenses and interest. You're required to make appropriations to allow monies to be withdrawn from the Treasury. And if there's a deficiency of funds, you're required to provide the funds. This doesn't mean that there's any level of funds you need to approve, but it does mean that you need to approve or assure that there are funds available for the expenses that you approve, essentially a balanced budget. So we work with you as staff to help you in that achieving that particular outcome, which is your constitutional requirement. Oregon's budget policy is also noted in statute. These aren't just concepts that sound good or that, you know, seem reasonable. These are noted from the statutes, basically, again, balancing revenues and proposed expenditures, allocating resources to achieve the desired outcomes, measuring the program outcomes, we'll get back to that, and the progress toward them, encouraging savings and investments, planning for the short and long term, and providing accountability. I'm going to talk a little bit about our office, the Legislative Fiscal's Office, and we do have a mission in statute to promote the state's fiscal accountability. And we are a resource to all of you. We serve all legislators, and especially, of course, members of the subcommittees and full committees of Ways and Means. We provide objective research, analysis, and evaluation of tax expenditures, financial affairs, program administration, and agency operations, as well as staffing the operations of the committees while you're actually in session. We've been around a long time, since 1959, and we are nonpartisan, independent, and permanent professional staff. We're here year-round during the interim. We're working to learn more about the agencies and to provide budget information to you. We love organizational charts in LFO because it's one of the ways that we can analyze a budget and see why agencies, why it costs so much to run agencies and what they, how they're organized and what they do. You can see here that primarily in this part, we have a number of legislative analysts who perform a number of functions, including providing budget recommendations to you and providing fiscal impact statements. We have two analysts who are specifically dedicated to IT information technology issues and who have expertise in that area. And we have the fiscal office manager and other personnel. We hire additional personnel during the session to assist with the committee functions. During the session, we do a number of things, and I do want to point some of these out more than others, but basically what we are doing is we're staffing this committee, we're providing you with information that you need to make your decisions. We're responsive to questions. Please always feel, you know, if you have any questions about a budget or about an agency, let us know. We also review impacts of budget reductions or enhancements. The one that I'd like to, I always like to emphasize this one here. We make recommendations to the legislature related to agency budgets. This is somewhat different than a lot of legislative staff in the sense that we are required by statute. It's not something we've taken up on our own. But by statute, we are required to make recommendations to you for the legislation that's before you, which, as you know, typically your committee staff are not making recommendations and saying we recommend you vote for this or against this or this level or that level. But we do do that. And our recommendations are based on evaluations of the agency budgets and what we believe their needs are, and also understanding and directions from the co-chairs who are working to provide or to pass a balanced budget. So our recommendations are conformed to both of those. We also prepare fiscal impact statements. A lot of times people get angry with our fiscal impact statements. The purpose of a fiscal impact statement is not to kill a bill or to get a bill passed or anything like that. We are trying to get the best evaluation we can of what the costs would be or the savings would be of passing legislation so that we can adjust an agency's budget, if necessary, for the passage of the bill. So when we do a fiscal impact statement and it says, you know, in order to implement this, we believe the agency will need to hire one more person, and we believe that the total costs are going to be, you know, $527,000, the reason we are working on that is if the legislature approves the bill, we want to make sure that that appropriate budget adjustment is made so the agency will be able to do what the bill requires them to do. They will have the funds to do that. They won't come back and say, yeah, well, you told us to do that, but we didn't get any money, so we did the best we could and nothing happened.
Let me just add, for the benefit of our new members, based on my experience of observing these, the issue about having an expensive fiscal is that sometimes it dooms the bill. If something is going to cost a great deal of money, that would make it less likely to be included, particularly during very lean budget times like we're facing right now. And the other thing that I've watched and frankly observed, experienced personally, is I'm not so much miffed with LFO's analysis as I am sometimes miffed with the agency's assumptions of what they will need. If let's just take ODOT, for example. If ODOT doesn't like a bill, they come in and say it's going to take 23 people to implement this. And sometimes I think, and I'm not singling ODOT out, and if anybody in ODOT land is listening to this on the video monitor, it's not you. I'm using this as an example. But if the agency doesn't want the bill, they have a tendency to lard up the fiscal. And it is Mr. Bender and his colleagues' job to scrutinize that, to make sure that this isn't the agency pushing back in a kind of act of sabotage to get rid of a bill they don't like. Nothing like making it cost $20 bazillion. So I would find more fault with the agency sometimes than I do with LFO in analyzing the cost of these bills. And that's just the gospel according to Betsy. Representative Rubin.
Thank you. So I'm trying to learn the process from the experts. So in the past, when you think that possibly that has been larded up, great term, what's your recommendations for addressing that, and how do you
run right back down to LFO and have a visit with them?
Go through them.
This is team ways and means right here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you would go to Mr. Bender or the fiscal analyst that is charged with doing ODOT's work, because Mr. Bender's sort of the quarterback of team LFO for this committee. And then there are other players that have budget responsibility. So if I were doing this and I thought that an agency had tried to pull one over, I'd start with Mr. Bender as a courtesy, because he's our quarterback for this committee, and I'd ask for a meeting with him and the analyst and explain why I think that maybe the agency's estimation of the cost of implementation of a legislative concept is off base.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Bender.
Thank you. I'd like to just skip down in the interest of time to the last item here. Please note that one of the things that LFO does is we do assist bill carriers on the House and Senate floors, as well as in full committee. So if you are carrying a bill for Ways and Means, because these are budget bills, they're technical, they have a lot of numbers, we will prepare information that you can use as a floor speech if you choose to do that, that outlines some of the budget decisions that were made in that budget. We typically will, if you're carrying on the House or Senate floor, we'll always be on the side aisle, but we're happy to sit at your desk if you would like during the time that you're carrying the bill and it's during the third reading. So,
let me also add, for the benefit of our new folks, you are going to get bills. And they will be assigned, if you're sitting on this sub and on full, you're going to get bills. And it is a lifeline to have the trusty LFO analyst available to you. Some of these bills are highly contentious. And if they become partisan, the questions will have been researched as an attempt to try to draw out the faults in the bill. And it is an enormous comfort to have the LFO analyst there at your desk to be able to assist in responding to the technical aspects of a question. Senator Hansel.
That's what I was just going to make sure that was said. Some of these bills are highly technical, and you know, we're the carrier, but we don't have the background or the expertise. And you'll get asked a question that you honestly don't know what the answer is, and that's where the LFO is able to help.
And a piece of nomenclature that you may hear referred to is a pony. I don't know. That's where that originated is lost in the misty annals of time. But if you are carrying a bill at the full Ways and Means, it will be written up by the legislative analyst, and generally a single page, unless they're very complicated bills like DHS or the health authority. And then if you get into trouble in full and there's a question raised, Representative Meek, how come this, that, and the other thing? You may not know off the top of your head, and so you have the opportunity to throw out a lifeline and have the analyst come up to the witness table and respond to very technical and specific questions. You should not be shy about asking for that assistance. We all do it all the time. Senator Monroe.
Not all of the members of this subcommittee are on the full committee, so we wouldn't obviously assign you to carry it to full unless you're on full. But you might end up getting the opportunity to carry it to the House or the Senate, even if you're not on full.
Thank you. Okay. Continue, Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In the interim, LFO, we have different responsibilities than we do during the session. Primarily, we are staffing the emergency board and the interim joint committee on Ways and Means when they meet during the interims.
Could you stop and do a brief description of the difference between the emergency board and Ways and Means, particularly in the new era of annual sessions?
The emergency board is a very interesting animal. It's established in the Constitution, and the emergency board had met prior to there being annual sessions. The emergency board was generally the only vehicle that was available to adjust agency budgets during an entire two-year period between one and a half years between legislative sessions. This was when the legislature did not regularly meet in the even-numbered years. So the emergency board had that function. Currently, of course, we've now transitioned to annual sessions, but the emergency board has the same functions. That is to say, the emergency board can only meet when the legislature is not in session. So now there are basically two interims. There's the interim after the long session and the interim after the short session. During those times, the emergency board may meet. Most recently, since we've gone on to annual sessions, the legislative leadership has not called for meetings of the emergency board after the long session, but only after the short session. That's not a reason. They do not have to continue to do that. They can schedule an emergency board meeting after the long session as well. But under the annual sessions, I think they've been working under the theory or the practice that if an agency has a problem with their budget right after the long session when the budget was approved, They should be able to wait until this session, or I'm sorry, the short session in the even-numbered years for any necessary adjustments. And that's worked fine. During that time, though, the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means meets, as do other interim committees. When the Emergency Board meets, so far as I'm saying, only after the short sessions, it also it can basically perform any activity that the Interim Ways and Means Committee can, plus some major additional activities that are established for it by the state constitution. The primary thing that the Emergency Board can do that the Interim Committee on Ways and Means cannot do is it can actually adjust state agency budgets. So the Emergency Board can make some adjustments, not all. The adjustments that the Emergency Board can make are pretty substantial in nature. But, for example, it can approve new program expenditures. It can increase expenditures for programs beyond the level that the legislature earlier approved. And it has access to a limited amount of general fund that it could add to other agency budgets. It only has access to the emergency, to the amount of funds that the full legislative session provides during the long odd year session. That's to say, in this budget cycle, one of the appropriations that the legislature will approve will be an appropriation of a certain amount of general fund to the Emergency Board, which then the Emergency Board will have access to and will have authority to allocate to other state agencies during whenever it meets. And this will not require a full, you know, a vote of the entire Legislative Assembly, just a vote of the Emergency Board members. Did that answer your question or make things worse?
It did. The point is that it is a little confusing as we switch to annual sessions to know when the EBR Board has jurisdiction and when Ways and Means does. And there's slightly different processes for both of those. But yes, you fundamentally distinguish the two.
This slide just shows the various committees that we do staff in addition to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So we do staff the Emergency Board, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, and the Transparency Oregon Advisory Commission.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hansel.
Well, we're still kind of talking about staffing. I'm just curious. great staff, very competent. Just generally, what is it that when you hire a new staff or for when somebody comes on, what is the background? What are the academic areas that you're looking for as an experience? I'm just kind of curious.
The Senator and subcommittee members, the office hires staff with various backgrounds. We don't look for people with any particular course of degree or study. For example, we're not looking necessarily for economists or accountants or any particular area like that. But we hire people, we look for people that have a good background, have demonstrated ability to analyze issues and have an ability, we think or hope, to look at the types of budget questions that will be brought forward to them. So we really do have a somewhat broader type of staffing. Legislative Council, of course, they're going to be hiring attorneys and others who can work with attorneys to do that their work. Legislative Revenue Office hires economists. We have a much broader type of hiring.
Thank you.
One thing that we're proud of in LFO is that, and this reflects the organization of state government and the legislature, is that we are a single office. We serve both chambers. We serve both parties in both chambers. And this is not the way all states necessarily operate. Some states have as many as four legislative fiscal offices for the majority and minority in each in the House and the Senate, and end up developing four separate budgets. And in addition to being a more cumbersome process, it's also more expensive. We have 22 positions here at LFO, and some of these states have over 150 people working in their budget offices because they're duplicating this. So we understand how important it is for people in all caucuses and both sides of the both chambers to understand that we're working in an independent manner and providing analysis the best that we can. Let's see. I wanted to talk about the budget process now, if there aren't any questions.
Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Bender?
No question.
Senator Monroe.
Well, I'll give the same little short speech I gave this morning at Ed Sub. I believe, and I've said many times, that the joint ways and means process is among the great strengths of the Oregon system. If you compare what we do to, for example, the feds or many other states where they have a Senate budget and a House budget and they have to try to figure out how to marry the two, and it can be very cumbersome. There's been a few instances, Madam Co-Chair, that you probably remember, where we've gone away from the joint budget process and tried it with separate House budgets and Senate budgets. Invariably, when that happened, we ended up wasting time. Session grew into August or almost September, and it was a disaster. So become aware of the great strength of the joint budget process. Enjoy it, use it, but almost worship it, because it really is a great strength of our Oregon system.
Mr. Bender.
Here's a diagram that shows the cycle, the budget cycle. So it's shown as a cycle. I'm going to go a little bit out of order, though, and just start with number four here at the bottom. Because when we look at a new budget, such as the one that you're going to be analyzing, the first step chronologically, which occurred last spring, so it's coming close to a year ago now that this process began, was that the various state agencies prepare budget requests. We have a lot of acronyms in Ways and Means, and I try not to use them too often. Sometimes I fall back onto them, though, and please let me know if I'm saying something that doesn't make any sense. But the first acronym we have is the ARB, or the Agency Request Budget. Agencies present agency request budgets, which generally are not presented to you. They're public documents, so you can easily find out what they are. You can ask your LFO analyst what was in the agency request budget. But the agency request budgets are prepared and sent in almost all cases to the governor. When I say almost all cases, there are some budgets that the governor has no authority over and doesn't make budget recommendations on. Due to the separation of powers, that would include all the legislative branch agencies and all the judicial branch agencies. The governor also typically will not make recommendations on the budgets of other constitutional offices, such as the Secretary of State or the Treasurer's budget. But all of the other budgets, including, I believe, definitely all of the budgets in this subcommittee, the ARBs go, and the governor then reviews them and makes a recommended budget, which we call the governor's recommended budget, or the GRB. And this is the budget that you will be seeing, that agencies will be coming forward to you and asking you to approve the governor's recommended budget. The governor's recommended budget typically includes portions of the agency request budget, but not all of it, because there's never enough money to fund all of the things that the agencies independently request. So where we are now is we're at number six in the cycle. You, the legislature, will be reviewing the materials in the subcommittee from the executive branch and from other sources. You'll be holding hearings, and you'll be preparing a legislative balanced budget. Before you adjourn, you will have a legislatively adopted budget approved. And then we start what here was number one. Then the agencies go out and they basically start to their operations for the next 2 years under the budget you've approved. So that's what number one is saying. Then the agencies are implementing the budget with oversight from LFO and DAS, and tentative budget for the next biennium, they start to prepare it, and the cycle continues. The oversight function, LFO and DAS, LFO's oversight is fairly limited on a day-to-day basis, but what we do is we work with the agency to make sure that what you have directed them to do, that they're doing this, and that they're interpreting the budget as you passed it, and not making changes in which programs they're funding or how much they're funding. That is our oversight, but we have no particular authority over them. We can just explain to them that, no, don't do that. That's not what the legislature intended, that type of thing. And usually they are interested in what we have to say, to put it that way. And I'm going to pass over this, I think, of this because of time, but this is, again, looking at the odd year session and what's going on in a little more detail. But, I probably should note a few of this. Number two here, we're working with leadership and the co-chairs to prepare them for the budget review. As a result of some of that, as you know, the co-chairs have already issued an existing resources budget framework. They're setting up priorities and timelines for the session. We'll be talking more about the priorities tomorrow, specifically how they relate to the subcommittee. And the subcommittees are meeting, making recommendations. The recommendations go to full and then are approved by the legislature. If we don't have a budget approved, then you have to stay around for a while until one is.
And George.
Mr. Senator Hanson.
I'm finding this very, very helpful. I'm not sure I had this 4 years ago when I was sitting in this chair for the first time. So this has been very helpful. So forgive me if some of my questions are pretty basic. It dawned on me, are you folks involved? Is your department involved in the preparation of the governor's budget?
No.
Who does that?
The staff support for the governor's budget is the Budget and Management Office, BAM.
Okay.
Since they're in the CFO's office, we also refer to them sometimes just as the CFO office. So BAM and CFO are the staff who assist the governor in making her or his recommendation, and who work with the state agencies to make sure they're following the process to develop their budget requests. Although the governor's budget never includes everything that the agencies request, the governor typically will provide some guidelines to the agencies as to what they can request in the first place. We work with BAM staff. They will typically be here at the table with the state agency during the budget hearings and work sessions, so you can ask them questions. And we also work at a staff level on assumptions on the budget, so that we agree that the assumptions that they're using for the governor's budget are reasonable in many cases. One example, just a specific example, is there is an inflation factor that's allowed for some of the expenditures in the state budget in order to calculate what we call the current service level. And we're talking a lot about the current service level, but one of the typical things is this inflation rate varies from one biennium to the next because the level of inflation, in the economy changes. So we'll work with BAM staff to determine what inflation rate is reasonable. In this budget that you're getting here in the 2017-19 biennium, most services and supplies and other payments, the inflation rate that's assumed is that prices are going to be 3.7% higher this biennium than they were during the prior biennium. So over basically a two-year period, costs are going to increase by 3.7%. And we can talk more about that number. It's higher than it was 2 years ago, but fundamentally, we use the same methodology, but with the updated data, it was 3.7%. You may decide that that's nice, but agencies, we don't have 3.7%. We're not going to give you that money. That's a decision you can make, but we're building a base budget assuming a certain amount of inflation in there.
Follow-up, Senator Hanson.
I know where your offices are. Where are the BAM offices?
The BAM offices are in the executive building. They're the next building over.
Oh, okay. And then quick follow-up. But when it comes to co-chairs' budgets, are you actively involved in helping them, right?
Yes. Okay. We serve as your staff in a parallel manner. We BAM is the parallel to LFO in the executive branch.
Thank you.
Please continue.
I think there was one thing I wanted to point out. I skipped over it. I just want to mention it. We do prepare a number of reports that can be very helpful to you. And I would recommend that if you have a question about a particular state agency in detail, for example, if you just want to read about a state agency, what do they do, what's in their budget, we prepare a document that's on the LFO webpage that is called the Detailed Analysis of the Legislatively Adopted Budget we prepare after each long session. So the most recent one is almost 2 years old now, but it does explain what was in the current budget of the agency in some detail. And that is a good resource if you have questions. And if you do at any time, I can help you locate that if you have trouble finding exactly what I'm talking about. But that was just one thing I passed over. Okay, budget process. The budget, we categorize all expenditures in the budget into one of four different types of fund types, depending on where the money is coming from that's supporting the expenditure that's being approved. Those four are the general fund, lottery funds, other funds, and federal funds. I want to take a few minutes just to talk about what each of those are and how they're different from each other. In some sense, the way that they differ is more important than what they are. Maybe not, but at least I think so. First is general fund. General fund is fungible, and by what we mean by that is it could be used for a lot of different things. It's basically monies that are not restricted in law to a certain particular program or to a certain particular agency, and therefore it's spread throughout most of the state budget to support different programs. The general fund is almost exclusively comes from income taxes. Personal income tax generates about 87% of the general fund. If you add the corporate income tax on top of that, 93% of the general fund comes from income taxes. Income taxes vary with incomes. So as the economy moves through its typical cycle, we have periods of time when there's a lot of income tax money coming in and times when there's not so much. The other 7%, there are various sources. None of them are very large. The two largest of all of them, in case you're interested, would be the estate tax that's levied upon estates, and which is collected from a fairly small number of returns in a particular biennium, and the liquor money from OLCC. A portion of that goes to the general fund. Each of those contribute only about 1.5% each of the total, but it's not an insubstantial amount of money. Each of those is about $270 million per biennium. So even though after the income taxes, the next biggest source only is 1.5%, if it weren't there, you would notice it, and it would make the budget situation harder if all of a sudden $270 million was not available. All of these general fund sources totaled about $18 billion during the current biennium that was budgeted 2 years ago and which still has about 5 months left. For the 17-19 biennium that you're going to be budgeting for this session, it's projected there's going to be $19.5 billion. So it's going up from $18 billion to $19.5 billion. That's about 8.3% increase. You may wonder, is an 8.3% increase a lot or a little historically? How does that compare? Well, 8.3% is actually a kind of a lower than normal or a lower than typical increase. For example, when the legislature met in 2015, they were looking at a situation where general fund was increasing by 12% from the prior biennium. And there's a big difference between 8 and 12%. I mean, you know, the impact of that is great. According to the state's revenue forecast, in 2019, growth is going to pick up again a bit, back to 10%. So this is a somewhat lower than normal general fund growth that's occurring at this time. And it's the main reason for that is the economic recovery is fairly mature, and we don't see the recovery from low levels of income that we do when we're just coming out of a recession anymore. We're now in a mature phase, and things are not, revenues are not growing as quickly as before.
Yeah. Representative Bruton.
New guy question. So I just tend to think of my home budget and my own income and stuff, and maybe it's going up 2-2.5%. And could you help me understand how the state budget has to go up 8%? That's just really confusing.
We're just talking, Representative, here about the revenue side, and the question: why is the revenue? Why are revenues growing that rapidly?
If it's just revenue, I'm sorry, yeah. I misunderstood. Then,
and of course, in addition, most of these are income based, and we do have some incomes that are fluctuate much more than most wage or salary income.
That makes sense to me. I was thinking more of how much we were spending.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, the 8.3% is a good number to remember, because if we only have to spend 8.3% more, we're fine. Well, we should be able to afford it. If costs are going up by more than 8.3%, there's going to be a problem. If they're going up by less than 8.3%, there may be opportunities, even under the existing tax structure, to address issues that haven't been able to address before. So the 8.3 number is important, but I have to tell you that our next source of funds is lottery funds, which are the monies that are generated by the operation of the state lottery. These funds are dedicated to economic development, education, parks, and salmon habitat. And we can now add, as a result of the voters' passage of Measure 96, to veteran services as well. Lottery funds are dedicated to these areas, but as a practical matter, they turn out to be fungible, like the general fund, because education, you put a lot of your lottery dollars into education, but there's not enough lottery to fund all of education from the lottery. Most of the education support is funded from general fund. The lottery fund supplements it. And that supplementing feature makes the lottery fund fungible, because you can determine how much of the lottery will supplement general fund for education.
But just by way of a little editorial sideboard, I think when these things are seen in isolation, it's easy to look at a ballot measure that sequesters even more of the lottery. Let me give you my favorite. Paying to send kids to camp. Seen in isolation, is not sending children out into the grandeur of Oregon a good thing? Might be. But because of the fungibility of this money, it could end up causing there to be 45 third graders in a classroom. And I think had people made that trade-off, they might not have sequestered the rest of the lottery. The lottery is the most flexible money after general fund that we have. And I think some of us have lived through sessions when the lottery saved our bacon because we had that money to preserve core programs. And that's getting more difficult as more of the lottery money is being appropriated via ballot measure for very specific functions. Senator Hansel.
Would you define fungible for me, please?
It's a sneaky elephant word for flexible.
Fungible is flexible. It is not dedicated to specific use. And other funds we'll see are not like that. But again, referring again to the lottery funds are not growing, are not projected to grow at 8.3%. They're only projected to grow about 1.5%. And since on a budget basis, we look at the general fund and lottery fund together, when you average that all out, instead of the revenues growing by 8.3%, they're only going to grow by 6.2% because you have most of it's growing by 8.3%. A smaller portion is only growing by 1.5%. The weighted average is a 6.2% growth. So that's a good number to remember, because now we see that if costs are increasing by not more than 8.3%, but if they're increasing by more than 6.2%, they're going to be increasing faster than the revenues available. The other two types of revenue or expenditures, are other funds and federal funds. Other funds are the most complicated of all because they are not general fund, they are not lottery funds, they're pretty much anything else. So it's a catch-all category. The important thing about other funds, though, is that generally they are specifically in statute limited to a particular agency or to a particular purpose within an agency. There are a number of sources of other funds. Many sources. I tend to, in my own mind, break them up into two, though. One of them is from revenues that come to a state agency from fees or charges or certain types of taxes that the agency collects that don't go into the general fund. The largest of this last category would be a gas tax, for example. Gas tax is a tax. ODOT collects it, and it doesn't go into the general fund. So it's in other funds in the budget. But there are various fees and charges. All of them are established by statute somewhere to allow a state agency to collect them. Sometimes there's a specific dollar amount or rate in statute. Gas tax, the rate is in statute. ODOT can't change that. Only the legislature can. Sometimes the authority to establish fees is in statute, but the agency has flexibility. Those will be budget issues as well. The second broad category of other funds are bond proceeds. So when the state issues debt for something to fund anything, the expenditures of the bond proceeds are other funds. And those are a little different, and when we go through these budgets, you'll see we have to look at these a little differently sometimes. Federal funds are, as they say, as it sounds, money that comes from the federal government. There are some cases where federal funds show up as other funds in the budget, and we'll discuss that. But primarily, there are two main sources of federal funds. Either the federal government has established a program that provides money to states, and the state has designated a certain state agency to be the state participant in this program. So there will be ongoing programs that are federally funded or federally supported where the monies go to particular state agencies because the state has designated these as the agencies to be the state partner in these programs. Those expenditures show as federal funds. The other category of federal funds are outside of this. It's when there's a competitive grant where an agency has to apply for funds because they're not a designated state agency for this particular program. They may be designated by the federal government as the only agency that's allowed to apply, but it's still an application process. This is another function that you'll be seeing here in Ways and Means, because when an agency applies for federal funds of this nature, where there's competitive grant process, they are not allowed by state law to even apply unless you approve the application. Then, if they are successful, you have to approve adjusting the budget. You have to give them more federal funds expenditure limitation because they're getting more money. But this is part of the process that the legislature's established to ensure that you have say in state agency operations, when they go out and they apply for federal grants, you determine whether this is something that you think it's appropriate for them to apply for. And sometimes, you know, because of timing, they do this retroactively. If they don't have time to ask you, they'll send in the application, but then you review it retroactively. And if retroactively you say no, you shouldn't have done that, the agency has to withdraw its application. But you'll see that come up at times during the session where it will schedule a federal grant application where you'll have to decide whether it's appropriate or not for the agency to even submit that grant in the first place.
Senator Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Before we leave this slide, I want to make sure I've got the right things. We had an 8.3 increase in income. But when you combine it with, was it the lottery fund increase, and that was 1.5%
roughly.
1.5%. It then the actual growth for this budget that we're going to look at is 6.2.
Right. For the general fund, lottery fund portion, the fungible portion, the part that isn't already dedicated or designated to one use or another by statute.
Thank you.
Another way of categorizing expenditures is not by the source of the money, but how the money's used. And any of these funds can be used for any of these different purposes. These can be funded by other funds, federal funds, lottery funds, whatever. But the main categories are personal services, which is the cost of, salaries plus fringe benefits for state agency employees. So these are people who are actually employed by the state. These are budgeted as personal services.
Mr. Bender, you might stop there just for the benefit of our new colleagues and discuss how those wages are negotiated and who gets the bill.
This is the way that the the governor, as the head of the executive branch, gets to choose compensation plans for executive branch agencies, which are most of the agencies, subject to the fact that a large number of state employees participate in collective bargaining, and their compensation is determined through a collective bargaining process. The employees that are not members of bargaining units, basically the governor approves compensation plan changes for them that typically will reflect the major components of the collective bargaining agreements. The major components of the collective bargaining agreements typically are cost of living adjustments, whether there are any, if there are, how much they are, when they are. There will also be collective bargaining agreements that deal with, fringe benefits, including, to what extent, if any, there's employees pay for health insurance or retirement through reductions in their compensation. And, of course, there are working conditions, terms of working conditions that are also part of these collective bargaining agreements, which don't necessarily directly translate into budget numbers. But the way that this works is that for the executive branch agencies, for example, during this budget process, you are going to be receiving what we call current service level numbers that are calculated to reflect what the cost would be if the current employees, or the employees actually who were employed back at a date that was in last April, if those employees all stayed in the jobs at their salary levels, what would it cost to fund their salary and benefits in this 2017-19 biennium? That is how, in a nutshell, the personal services component of the CSL is determined. That does not include any cost of living adjustments, future cost of living adjustments, but it does phase in all of the cost of living adjustments that were awarded in the current biennium, and it does allow employees who are eligible for step increases or annual merit increases that are not at the top of their range to receive those. In terms of the elements, though, that, for example, would be issues in the next collective bargaining agreements, such as future cost of living adjustments, the current service level does not include any money for those. What you do or can do or have the option of doing is to provide funding to fund cost of living adjustments or other compensation plan changes. And the way that this is done, when it is done, is you're not going to know what the compensation plan changes are when you adjourn, because the agreements probably are not going to be completed, typically aren't completed until after you're out. But the co-chair's budget or the legislatively approved budget at that point can contain a set of money which we call, typically is called the salary pot, that is just appropriated to the emergency board. It's not distributed. And then after the agreements are made, the money is available for you to allocate in the future if you choose to do that. The costs of the agreements become costs. I mean, these are the compensation rates that are set. You provide funding, and the funding that you provide may or may not cover all of the cost. If it does not, the agencies have to find other ways to finance those costs, typically by holding back on other expenditures, including perhaps allowing vacancies that come up to be held longer than they would otherwise want to in order to generate those funds.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Bender, first of all, thanks for the presentation. This is, I echo Senator Hansel's thing. I was new 2 years ago, and I could have used this, but it's helpful to me now. And I was just going to bring up that topic of vacancies. So if an agency has a vacancy, what happens to the money that was appropriated to that? Are there any limitations on it?
There are no specific limitations. If you fund for, suppose, for example, you choose to pass an agency's budget at exactly the current service level, which you could do, in that current service level, there will be funding for all of the agency positions for the full 24 months with a small adjustment that's built in to reflect an average vacancy rate that agency normally has. So there's somewhat of a reduced amount of funding. But to the extent that the agency going forward does not fill positions and has more vacancy than they normally would because they're, as a budget action, they're choosing not to fill the positions, they retain those funds, and they can use those funds typically to meet other costs as well. So they can, for example, if there's not enough funding in the compensation pot, they can use that to pay for the cost of a fewer number of employees, or they can, in some cases, use it for services and supplies or other things that they may be, for example, they might hire a contractor to do something that they would otherwise perhaps have done in-house by the employees.
Thank you.
The question that you didn't ask, Mr. Nierman, but I will provide an answer for you, is can those vacancies be manipulated by agencies and leave lots of open positions with very flexible money? The answer would be yes.
Madam Chair?
Senator Hansel.
It seems to me sometimes I get the feeling the executive branch and the collective bargaining agreements, based upon what you said in your introduction, is that they say it's not our wallet, legislature, you get to haul it.
Please continue, Mr. Bender. Sprint to the finish.
Madam Co-Chair, I might recommend that this might be a good time. We're almost done, because I think that tomorrow's presentation won't be as under such time constraint, and this would be a good place to, a natural place to break it and to carry forward.
Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Bender? Representative Noble?
More comment. I very much appreciate your thoroughness. I've spent quite a few years in municipal budgets, Smaller scale by far, but very much appreciate the outline, and it's really not too much different. I've worked in a city where personal services and non-personal services were allocated separately, so you didn't have that flexibility that was just talked about, and then a city where it was allocated by department, where we did have the flexibility, but I do appreciate the overview.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the chair, what was the other comment you didn't make? You asked us specifically about the relationship between collective bargaining and current service levels. May I ask if there was a thought behind that?
I don't even remember saying it. How's that?
Well, then I will ask a question. And so as I want to make sure I think I understood something. So we set a budget for a department, and then there are contracts negotiated which would elevate their expense level. And then that becomes a new current service level for the following cycle, correct? Okay. So the question was, who's in charge of the budget? Is that?
Thank you for giving me focus again. The whole salary situation is one that's quite complicated, and it is another term of art in Ways and Means that you're going to hear, and that's roll-up costs. So that it costs X in this biennium, but by the time you calculate its effect on the next biennium, you've got a much higher number.
Right.
The main point that I was trying to make was that the personal services are negotiated in some instances away from the legislature, and the legislature just gets the bill. And we have to try to fit that into our budget framework, even at the expense of other core services, because regardless of how much money we have, at some point there is a terminus. We run out of money. There is an insatiable need and a finite amount of money. And so we end up with conflict with this kind of a construct. It's magnified by school districts where you've got, I forget how many there are now, 196, all negotiating independently, and since ballot measure 5, ostensibly sending the bill back to the legislature. So it's a situation where we end up having to provide the resources but are not necessarily there at the bargaining table helping to cut the deal. Have I strayed from the truth?
No, Thacker, I think in one sentence, I think the best way to put it is the legislature does not have authority to establish the salary and compensation rates for other than the legislative employees themselves. So your legislative employees, you can do that.
Representative Gomberg, then Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Bender, great presentation. I can't wait to hear it again at 3 o'clock in general government. that being said, again, for the benefit of our newer members here, I wonder if you we're dealing with a lot of nomenclature here, and there's a couple of phrases we're going to hear a lot in the coming months. I wonder if you could help us better understand what they are. I'm thinking key performance measures and policy option packages. Could you define those for us?
Key performance measures are legislatively approved measures of an agency's performance. I'm sorry to use the words in the definition. I should think of this better. But you will see, and when we meet tomorrow, we're going to look a bit at a budget report to show how you do this. But you actually will decide and approve how you're going to determine how well a particular agency is meeting the goals that you want it to meet. So key performance measures are particular measures that are measured quantitatively. It's not just a discussion. You have to be able to show how an agency is operating. A policy option package is part of a budget that is an adjustment to current service level. So a policy option package, which we often just call a POP, is either something you add to or take away from an ongoing budget. So all of the agencies, the 12 agencies whose budgets you're working on, they all have budgets now. They all have programs now. If you want to add something to what they're doing or take something out, you'll do that through what we call a POP. And we put specific numbers on POPs, and that's how we formally let the agency know through the budget process what else you're funding or what you're asking them or telling them to not do anymore.
Thank you. Other questions, colleagues? Representative Nierman.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So, you may have partially just answered my question here. The question I was going to ask is, if I want to make a change to an agency budget, what's the process that I go about doing that, both to the services that they provide, either adding or taking away, and to their key performance metrics? How would I go about doing that?
The way that the subcommittee would go about doing that would be to approve, or to recommend a POP that's either adding or taking something out. Key performance measures, the subcommittee would also approve changes to those. So the process would be to make sure that the subcommittee is aware of the changes that you would like to have included in the budget. But then those would be included and passed on to full Ways and Means.
Let me give you two experiential examples. The key performance measures, some agencies have got too many, in my view. They're so busy chasing their metrics, they don't have time to service the customer. And they will come in and ask to have them changed. I just had a meeting with one of our agencies, DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they have 14 key performance measures, and they want to have an adjustment. I said, you better not be adjusting the ones that you did poorly in. So we'll want to keep our eyes open for that, and we'll also want to keep our eyes open as a committee to make sure what they're measuring are really true indices of outcomes, not outputs. You can run 28 people through a program, but if all 20 of them, 8 of them fail, what good is it? And so that's the kind of stuff that we're going to be wanting to look for. The other thing he went through were policy option packages, and I got the two little ones. One of them actually is a reduction, which doesn't happen very often. Almost all of the policy option packages are give me what you gave me and give me some more. But this one was actually a reduction. I'm sure that he led with that one because it mirrored the fact that one of the other ones adds 16 full-time employees. We will debate that as a committee, but the point that I'm making here is you'll get a shot at those. If you want to substantially change the agency, you'll probably have to go through a policy committee. But to the degree that the Ways and Means has pretty much unilateral control over manipulating the key performance measures, you'll get a bite at that apple.
Thank you.
Did I lie? Good. Okay. Senator Monroe, you get the last word.
Beware of new programs that are brought in during a portion of a biennia, sometimes 1 year, sometimes only a half a year, that the roll-up costs then for the next biennia may be twice or four times those costs. Just have to watch them.
Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Because they'll try to sneak one in on you. This will only cost a little bit because we're only funding it for the last 6 months of the biennia, when you got to understand that for the following full biennia, it might be four times that much.
With that, the mass is ended.
Can I bring
Representative Nierman, you get the last word.
Thank you. So just two little quick little things. One of them is I had to grow a new muscle in my brain, a biennial muscle there. So when they say, we need to add a new position, it's going to cost $175,000, that gets spread over 2 years, and it's a little bit easy to digest. When you're talking about an increase of revenue of 6%, and I say, hey, my constituents' incomes didn't go up 6%, that's over a two-year period, so it's really 3% or whatever. Something. The other thing that I was going to say is kind of a personal thing is I have a committee that conflicts with this one on Thursdays, and the work of this committee is very important, and I want to be committed to helping with quorums and things, but I may have to spread my time between the IT committee, and feel free to come and grab me by the ear out of that. It's just pretty convenient across the hall on Thursdays. So.
Well, if you just make sure we know what your schedule is.
I will.
With that, colleagues, we're adjourned. With that, colleagues, we're adjourned.